The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 13th of July 2022 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up, the UK's Conservative MPs begin the process of deciding who will replace Boris Johnson as their leader and as the country's Prime Minister. But will the party's membership agree with them? Also ahead, Japan considers honouring the late Shinzo Abe by revisiting his dream of revising the country's pacifist constitution. We'll have an update from Tokyo. Plus, we'll find out why some of the world's busiest airports are imposing passenger caps. And Fernando Augusto Pacheco has the latest on the Emmys.
Hello, Andrew. Today we talk about TV's most prestigious award and why Succession is a shoo-in for the win.
That's all coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. And welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. The list of contenders to become the next leader of the UK's Conservative Party and therefore the next Prime Minister is down to eight. Rather a shame, as the Seven Dwarves jokes would have written themselves. The next hurdle for each candidate to clear is to scare up the backing of 30 of their parliamentary colleagues. Further ballots over the next few days will whittle the field to two, from which a winner will be chosen by the Conservative Party's membership of 200,000 and mad retired colonels. I'm joined now by Monocle 24's Westminster watcher, Vincent McAvenny. Vincent, bookmakers now have Penny Mordaunt just ahead of Rishi Sunak. It's fair to say, I think, that until very recently, Penny Mordaunt was not a household name. Where has she come from?
Yeah, and that was something that she's been quizzed about at the launch of her campaign this morning. Now, Penny Mordaunt has been someone who's been in a range of posts. She was for a short time defence secretary a couple of years ago. She's recently been a minister in the cabinet office. She was also the international development minister. So she's someone who's had quite a bit of experience around Whitehall, but she isn't that much of a public face of the party. In fact, probably the thing she's most known for is a good few years ago, she took part in a charity reality TV show on Saturday night called Splash on ITV, in which Tom Daley, the Olympian, got celebrities to do dives from various high boards, and she did that. So she is someone that still many people won't have actually heard of, even in this country.
Nevertheless, she is one of the, I guess you could say, three favourites now, along with Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss. Is it realistically now going to be one of those three? Do any of the outsiders still have any hope here?
It's going to be really interesting to see, because yesterday they only had to get 20 nominations. As you mentioned, today they've got to get 30 nominations. So it's about siphoning off from those who dropped out, like Grant Shapps and Sajid Javid. And also a bit of the dark arts goes on. So what happened last time with Boris Johnson is there were accusations that his team was actually using their own voters who were going to back them within the MP pool to prop up other candidates and then remove support from them so they could control who was getting into the final round. So there could be a bit of dark arts going on over the next couple of hours with that. But it does feel like they're emerging as the sort of top pack, Rishi, Penny and Liz Truss, as you mentioned. And there seems to be a bit of a pull. Liz Truss has been trying to corner the the sort of right side of the party, getting people like Jacob Rees-Mogg, getting people like Nadine Dorries, and we think potentially Priti Patel, who hasn't publicly declared yet, but we assume will in the next few hours, to come out in favour of her as the sort of Brexiteer candidate. But really, a lot of the Brexiteer wing are also saying, well, Penny Mordaunt was actually a Brexiteer. She didn't back Remain like Liz Truss did. She's a true Brexiteer. And that's something that Penny this morning in her launch was really trying to say, that Boris delivered it, but she'll be the one to see it through safely.
We did see very early on one of the favourites, current Defence Secretary Ben Wallace, bailing out of this. Is there any possibility you're aware of that we might see one of the other contenders, and I mean one of the serious contenders, suddenly announce that on further reflection they don't want to do this?
I don't think we'll get that. I think that kind of culling came yesterday. I think all of the contenders now, unless they'll be doing their own private count, trying to work out what they've got. If they know for certain that they're not going to cross 30, then they might try and cut a deal with someone that they think could use their nomination votes and try and secure themselves a bigger job in that cabinet. So you might get Kemi Badenoch, for instance, who's quite an unknown as well, who's running. Potentially Suella Braverman, who kind of just, we think, scraped across the line yesterday. They might decide to drop out, but at this stage I think they're all sound like they're just going to keep on going and try to get through.
It does seem a reasonable assumption that Rishi Sunak will be one of the final two. If he does make it that far, how does he win? You will have seen this poll, I'm sure, by Conservative Home of Tory Party members, who are of course the ones who will make the decision, which suggests that he probably loses to pretty much every possible contender but Tom Tugendhat, who is extremely unlikely to be the person he has to beat.
Yeah, I mean, we have to keep remembering, and I think as well, the campaigning issues. So the fact that we're not hearing a word really from anyone on issues like climate change, and particularly even some rowing back from the what has been put into law by Theresa May, confirmed by Boris Johnson, that the UK will go net zero by 2050 as a way of kind of generating both investment and industry, but also bringing down our carbon emissions. So that voter membership is about 170,000, mostly retired, mostly straight white male. The things that you're hearing from the candidates are very much trying to get to them. So you had this morning Penny Mordaunt saying that she would prioritise cutting the VAT on fuel and raising the income tax bans. They're very much trying to talk to that demographic, whereas Rishi is trying to play a pretty sensible game. He is trying to say, look, I've seen the finances. We need to tackle inflation. The way to do that right now is not by lowering taxes. We've got to do this, and has accused the others of spouting fairy tales and myths. And I think that probably is sitting well with the sort of some members of the broader public, but with this, the group, the paid up, 170,000 want to hear low regulation. They want to hear low taxation. They want what some members like Penny Mordaunt, like Suella Braverman have been selling as their Brexit vision, which is essentially Singapore on sea.
So should those of us who don't get a vote in this contest be taking any of this at all seriously? Is anybody saying anything which gives any indication of the kind of Prime Minister they're likely to be, or are they just pandering to that extremely niche electorate you mentioned?
I think there is some pandering going on, and there's been a bit of a sort of strange play at the moment of quizzing them on the sort of so-called culture war issues. Now, a lot of this is a distraction, many people will argue, from the mistakes and the problems this government is facing that everyone will be experiencing, the cost of living crisis, the scandals that erupted during the pandemic years. That's something that in the hustings they were quizzed on last night, and Penny Mordaunt this morning was asked to define what a woman is. And she said that she believes in biological women, and she says she knows from her time serving in the Navy that there are physical differences between men and women, and stopped it there. So I think she's trying to float slightly to that audience, which has become very consumed and very sort of enlivened by the trans debate that's going on in this country, that she is someone who is not willing to duck that, which I think is something that Rishi still is going to have to come up with an answer for that demographic, because that seems to be, even though it is completely way at the bottom of the vast majority of the public's issues, within the Conservative Party, this has become a real red hot issue. And there are also sort of talk flying around that's Penny Mordaunt, and I think she's trying to correct this, when she was in government working on a bill, she had tried to use the term pregnant people. When it was then tried to be changed by others in the cabinet to pregnant women, she had resisted that. So I think we can see that in the next few days, I think particularly at the TV debates, those culture war issues are going to become something that they're all going to be tested on.
Vincent McAvenny, Monocle 24's Westminster Watcher, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. Now, the great unrealised dream of the late Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, assassinated last week, was an overhauling of the pacifist constitution imposed on his country after World War II. Abe wanted Japan, in this as in other respects, to be a normal country. And there is now some suggestion that this ambition may be realised. Well, I'm joined with more on this by Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief and Asia Editor Fiona Wilson. Fiona, was this in the wind anyway, or has there been renewed discussion of it following Abe's death?
To be honest, it's been in the wind since about 1955. I mean, since the founding of the Liberal Democratic Party, which is Shinzo Abe's party, constitutional reform has been on the agenda. So this constitution that was written by the Americans hasn't been changed in any way since 1947. And, you know, there's a huge discussion. A lot of the discussion I notice outside is focused on Article 9, which is the bit where Japan renounces the use of force to resolve disputes. But actually, in Japan, you know, constitutional reform also talks about there are other issues. It's also about, you know, governance. What does the government, what is its power in an emergency? And obviously, Japan has many natural disasters and emergencies. And it's also talking about that. But I think the focus for many people is about this issue around, you know, will Japan no longer have a pacifist constitution? Ambitions has been to put the self-defense forces on a sound legal basis and have them mentioned in the constitution. Which would be a huge change.
Well, you mentioned there the self-defense forces, which is the somewhat euphemistic title which has been bestowed upon the Japanese military all these years. And it's a significant fighting force, the Japanese army. It's not like they're an unarmed, entirely defenseless nation. But what does the LDP, or what do supporters of changing the constitution want to be able to do that they can't do now?
Well, I think the big problem for the self-defense force is, you know, it's in the name. It's a defensive force, a very, very well, as you say, very well equipped force. But it has a very vague status in Japan. And if you're in Japan, you know, you rarely even see members of the SDF around. And I think what the LDP is wanting is to make Japan's SDF like a regular army. Now, moving it into an attacking force is a big change. And I think this is the big hurdle. At the moment, it just responds to a crisis. It responds in a defensive way. It can also, there was a slight change. It can now they have this collective security. It can come to the aid of an ally in who needs its support if it affects Japan as well. So it's been a slight twinge, but not this major shift into making it a regular army. That would be a massive change. And this is the big problem for making any kind of change. You do now have a two-thirds majority in the upper and lower houses for constitutional reform, but it's a group of parties and they don't all agree on what exactly they want out of constitutional revision. And Kometo, which is the LDP, the ruling party, their junior coalition partner, Kometo, critical group of people, they're a pacifist party. They don't want the SDF codified into law. So you can see how many problems that potentially.
I mean, there are a lot of countries in the vicinity with extremely recent historical reasons to be concerned about any such change in posture by Japan, most obviously South Korea and China, but both would obviously object. But would those objections be actually serious, or would they just be putting on a show? Does anybody in Beijing or Seoul think Japan now is really the Japan of the 1930s?
I don't think they really do, but it's a very, very soft target, isn't it? I mean, it's a very easy thing for Beijing to do, and they frequently do when it suits. They can whip up a sort of anti-Japanese feeling by bringing up, events of 70-odd years ago. And I think, you know, it's easy to do that. I don't think they think Japan is a threat in any way, but it's certainly it would come up massively. I mean, you can see a politician from the LDP only needs to go to Yasukuni Shrine, this shrine where the war dead are enshrined. They just have to do that. And there are howls of disapproval from China and South Korea. So can you imagine what constitutional reform, this change of Article 9, what that would do would be very, very tricky.
Is it possible to say how actual Japanese public opinion on this tracks? It always seemed to me, at least, and you will know far better than I do, that this was vastly more a concern of the LDP than it was of the Japanese public.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're right. It is a huge issue for the LDP. It was an absolutely huge issue for Shinzo Abe, most definitely. And I think, you know, that's another problem. You know, since his death, the figurehead for that movement, that revision of Article 9, has now gone. That takes away momentum. I think if you're asked talking about popular support, it is very tricky. And, you know, many people will say they are quite supportive of constitutional reform. But as I've just said, it's the bits of constitutional reform that they support. And when it came to the election, you know, we just had an election on Sunday, they're extraordinarily low figures for people who made their decision. They decided who they were voting for based on constitutional reform. I mean, it's so negligible. You know, even among LDP voters, just over 3% cast their vote on this issue of constitutional reform. It's not really featuring in any way as much as the economy. That's the big issue. And that's the thing that people are talking about more than anything. Economy, absolutely. National security is an issue. But everyone who was asked, this is where their priority is. And even in his speech after his election win, Fumio Kishida, the prime minister, really mentioned constitutional reform as a bit of an afterthought. It was really about, he really wants to focus on the economy. That's the issue he was talking about.
And just finally, and it's where we came in, I guess, with the just astonishing, bizarre death of Shinzo Abe last week, you know, the country's most influential post-war politician gunned down in the street in a country where gun crimes of any sort are vanishingly unusual. What's the national conversation been like since that happened?
Yeah, I mean, absolute shock about what happened. I think people are really, as the story is coming out about Tetsuya Yamagami, the man who shot Shinzo Abe, you know, you realize it was a quite bizarre, doesn't really do it justice, but it's not part of a movement that suggests there's a huge threat to politicians everywhere. He had a very specific grievance against the Unification Church, which he says had bankrupted his mother. And he in some ways connected this to Shinzo Abe. So it was a very, very unusual crime in every way. You know, the fact that he used a homemade gun, the fact that he used a gun, which is very rare in itself. But I think, of course, there's certainly, you know, a sense that security needs to be reviewed. And you look at the film, the security was simply not there for Shinzo Abe on that day. It was very easy for Yamagami to walk up behind him. And I went to stand outside Zojoji Temple yesterday to, you know, as the funeral was happening and Shinzo Abe came out. And there were, you know, definitely more police, I feel, than there might have been on another day. So you did notice that there was more security. But I think many people are keen not to see, you know, suddenly our politicians in a, you know, surrounded by police. So I think I'm hoping that it's not going to provoke a massive change.
Fiona Wilson in our Tokyo Bureau, thank you for joining us.
Monocle's bumper July-August double issue features our much-anticipated annual Quality of Life Survey, which names the world's most livable cities. The report is the product of months of number crunching, long discussions and on-the-ground research by a network of correspondents. It reveals which metropolises are doing the most for their citizens and where is providing inspiring examples of how to build a better future. See which city came out top, and if yours made the cut. Alongside dispatches on the business of language learning, briefings of the brands that will help you stay sharp, and the top songs for a summer soundtrack. Order your copy of Monocle's July-August double issue today, or subscribe to get instant access online.
You You are back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Muller, and a big hello to anyone listening to this while attempting to board a flight from Heathrow who has just joined the end of the queue for security somewhere near Hammersmith. In a bid to ameliorate the chronic chaos which has plagued the airport this summer, Heathrow has told airlines to stop selling tickets for flights. In addition, between now and September, outgoing passenger numbers will be capped at 100,000 per day. Well, I'm joined now by Murdo Morrison, the head of strategic content at Flight Global. Murdo, first of all, we should stress that this isn't just Heathrow, is it? This is happening elsewhere.
Yes, this is a problem that really the global aviation industry is facing with the rebound in travel, in air travel, after lockdowns and lots of people were made redundant, lost their jobs or left their jobs in the airport and the airline sector. And the almost faster than expected return of demand for air travel has really been at the root of this problem. If you look at Amsterdam Schiphol, they've had dreadful problems. Dublin has had problems. And there have been problems at airports in the US as well for quite some time, really stretching from the middle of last year. So this is not a problem that's exclusive to the UK.
But speaking as someone myself who in relatively recent memory has stood in a 2.5 hour queue for security and then sat on a plane on the runway for 2.5 hours before actually going anywhere, is it really that unexpected, this surge in demand? Are airports really genuinely surprised, or did they just try to scramble through this on the cheap?
Yeah, there is an element of that. I mean, there's a little bit of a blame game going on for the chaos. So the airlines, politicians blaming the airlines and the airlines blaming the airports and the airports saying, well, it's not our fault. You've sold too many tickets to the airlines. And also blaming, of course, all the third party services, the ground handling companies that are neither employed by the airlines or the airports. So that's the people who unload the baggage, the people who are often employed to do the check-ins at the desks. So there's a shortage of staff all round, and that's really causing the problems.
So has anybody put any kind of timescale on when these problems will be solved? I mean, I do understand that it's not a straightforward process recruiting people to work in airports, especially if they're going to work airside. There needs to be background checks, security and so forth. But for an airport like Heathrow, how far away is it from operating at what we used to think of as normal?
Well, they've set a target or set a date of the 11th of September as the end of this capping process. So after that, you know, a lot of this is going to be caused by the demand, the added demand for flying over the school holidays, there's not so much business travel at the moment. We'll return a bit more to business travel in September, but the surge in leisure travel over the summer really makes up for that, and that's really causing the spike at the moment. So in the UK, we saw it a few months ago with the travel around the Jubilee weekend and other holidays. It spikes again, of course, in the summer. So we will see it tail off a little bit in September. Not necessarily because they've got more people employed by then, but because there will be slightly less demand. But it's, you know, it is a problem that that everyone says that they're working on. They're taking very seriously. They're trying to recruit, but it's very, very difficult. When you think this industry came to a complete standstill during the lockdown, so people were laid off, people left the industry, and it's very, very difficult just to sort of press a button, press a switch, and get everyone to come back and return to their jobs after 12, 18 months, whatever it is. It's very, very difficult. And that's really the problem. People have moved on. People have gone and left the industry. They've trained for other things. And as you said, bringing people back, it's not just a case of, can you start Monday? You've got to train them for certain airside jobs, including security. They've got to have go through a sort of clearance security process themselves. So it's all very time consuming. And you can point all sorts of fingers of blame. I don't think anyone in the industry has really come out of this Smelling of roses.
Finally, and just quickly, Murdo, obviously people who've booked tickets just need to keep a close eye on communications from their airlines. But what about people who were thinking of booking tickets, who hadn't planned their clearly at this point spontaneous summer holiday yet? Should all those people just now be looking at places they can get to by train?
Yeah, there's an element of that. There are still plenty of flights available and will be even at Heathrow. But certainly, you know, there are other airports. Heathrow's business model is more around, connecting people on long haul flights and business travel rather than the sort of short haul leisure travel that maybe Stansted and Gatwick focus on a little bit more. I think the advice to passengers would be, still look at what you can get. There are still flights available. But yes, it is difficult. And of course, it's much better if your flight gets cancelled at 4 weeks' notice than 4 hours' notice, because at least at 4 weeks' notice, you've got a chance of changing your plans. At 4 hours' notice, that's when it becomes a major inconvenience.
Murdo Morrison at Flight Global, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing. Finally, on today's programme, the nominations for this year's Emmy Awards are in, and Monocle 24's Fernando Augusto Pacheco has been agog, poring over them for us all morning. Fernando, good afternoon. What have we learned? Which already over-rewarded and overpraised people are about to be yet further rewarded and praised?
I can see you're a big fan of the Emmys, right, Andrew?
And of awards ceremonies
exactly.
Generally.
But one thing about the Emmys that it surprises me, we're watching more TV than ever, and there's always talk about, will the Emmys become more important than the Oscars? We're not there yet. It's very hard to quantify television, Andrew. There's so much content out there. But I think the Emmys, they tried. I mean, there's been not so many surprises this year, but the main one that everybody's talking about is, and I think, I'm not sure if you have seen the series, it's clearly fantastic.
I have not, because it is buried in this country on a network which is inaccessible to me, and I simply cannot be bothered to find out how to watch it. This is Succession, of course.
This is Succession indeed. And in fact, we have a few seconds of their opening theme, which I think it's the most fantastic opening theme in recent years. Let's have a listen to this composition by Nicolas Britell.
Is indeed a stirring theme. Fernando, I am, with my thumb on the pulse, looking here at the list of the shows with most nominations: Succession, Ted Lasso, The White Lotus, Hacks, Only Murders in the Building, and Euphoria. I have never seen a minute of any single one of them. You could tell me anything at this point. Clearly, I'm going to believe it. Is there any kind of theme or pattern emerging at these Emmys about what kind of series is capturing the moment?
I think there's a lot of sharp satires, I would say. I think this is... It's been a good year, and I quite like it. I think one example that I would like to mention is The White Lotus, which got 20 nominations. It's fantastic. It's set in Hawaii in a very expensive hotel, and they make fun of all the wealthy guests that you would usually find in a hotel like this. But the script is so witty. It's fantastic. Jennifer Coolidge, I mean, of course, she was nominated for her role as Tanya. She's doozy. She has the role of her career. That's a really fantastic one. I would definitely recommend you. And apparently there will be a second season, not with the recurrent guests. They will move to another hotel and have some sort of similar story as well. But a lot of satire, I would say. Hacks is another one, which is a mentorship between a Las Vegas comic artist, much older, and and then she has to work with a younger assistant. So there's kind of this clash of ideas because she comes from a different generation. But again, it's funny. It's a dark humor. It's very, very good as well.
It says here, Fernando, he said, rustling the script for Verite, that Squid Game is the first non-English series ever to be nominated for Best Drama. Can that possibly be right?
Well, I was surprised as well. And perhaps that's one of the problems of the Emmys, because the Oscars, they are becoming a little bit more international. And we are watching more series from outside our countries, even in the United States. So I'm glad that they're finally opening up to this. I guess they couldn't really refuse that, because Squid Game was one of the biggest hits from last year, the survival drama.
While I have, again, never watched a minute of it, I have at least heard of it. So the fact that it actually made it through my carapace of indifference to the point that I actually am aware that it exists does say something, I think.
Well, I am very happy with this, because people shouldn't be scared of subtitles, and Squid Game is fun, and they made kind of a mark in the popular culture all around the world, including the United States.
We are coming to the point, Fernando, which you're going to have to name your particular favourites. Who do you really want to see get up and give a long, inane and tedious speech thanking God?
Well, first of all, oh, thank you, HBO. Thank you so much. They are the top network with 140 nominations. And my favorite series come from HBO. I will repeat myself. I think The White Lotus is the one to watch.
Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you for joining us. That is all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Rhys James. Our researcher was Maya Renfer, and our studio manager was Chris Oblakwa. The Briefing returns tomorrow. I'll be back a bit later on with The Daily at 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Thank you for listening.